This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 386 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Alistair H.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along, beginning with chapter 71, entitled Black Pudding. The subtitle for this is bleh.
Gross, exactly. As we get started, Claire basically is making blood pudding, well, black pudding, excuse me, and fiddling with the blood when Ronnie Claire shows up with some whiskey casks. He complains about the ridge being built on a hill and doesn't really curse them out, but if he could have, he would have. So she offers him food, I guess, to calm him or to in exchange for what he's done.
I wonder why he's had such a hard time finding a mate.
That's been the case ever since
book four. He's not pleasant. He's not pleasant.
Yeah. I'm not saying he's a mean person, but he is definitely Diana seems to be excusing a lot of his behavior, meaning his gross behavior, his smarmy behavior as, yeah, because he wants a wife. So because he hasn't had it.
Yeah, but that almost seems like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, he just doesn't know how to be around women because he can't get a woman. I mean, but it's like that. How are you ever going to get a wife if you can't be pleasant?
If I'm not mistaken, he has been this way since day one. Now, yes, it has maybe gotten worse. And what we don't know is we don't know how long he'd either – I don't know if he's never had a wife or if he's a widow. I don't know. I think he's probably never had a wife. But in book four, when we meet him, it's possible that Jamie and Claire had already met him. But when Brianna shows up on the ridge, she, as one of the only, you know, women of marriageable age at that point, at least in the books, they don't push this in the show. They go by his outpost or wherever it is, because you have to go by Ronnie Sinclair, or you happen to go by his place as you get on your way to the ridge. So as they were taking, I guess it was Jamie, but as Jamie was taking Bree up to the ridge, they stopped by either the house or the whatever, the place where Ronnie was living or working. And I don't know if the drawing was Brianna or not. I believe Diana wants the reader to think it is based on Brianna. I don't think Diana writes that he leers at her, but because she's a woman of marriageable age, he definitely takes notice. And somehow at some point, Brianna walks around his, either the place where he lives or place where he works. He has taken, I think it's like a piece of wood ash, like a piece of wood that's left after a fire or something that has like charcoal. Mm-hmm. And he draws on the walls, like pictures either of naked girls or I don't know what it was. It was, but it was definitely some nudity of a woman. I don't think it was a woman and man together. I think it was of a woman. But anyway.
So he was making his own spank material.
Exactly. And so when she sees that, whether that's of her or inspired by her or not, she's freaked out, kind of grossed out, understandably so. So my point is, ever since we've met him, he's been a little bit of creeper to me, or smarmy. Yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, his condition, meaning his singleness or whatever, his lack of a bride, I'm not saying it doesn't make it harder. It could make it very much harder, excuse the pun, more difficult. Anyway, so we don't know how long he'd been single. I mean, maybe, again, if he's never had a wife, he's always been single. Mm-hmm. But we don't know how old he is either.
I know, but he's not wealthy enough to be that gross. You know, or to be that unpleasant. Oh. Like, people forgive a lot of things if they're like, well, he makes a good living. He'll take care of you. So you won't be hungry. So you can put up with his.
Well, he's not rich, but he is a very, very, very important. He plays a very important role.
He's not important enough.
What he does is definitely needed. I think he's a cooper. He puts together mm-hmm. barrels and stuff. I think so. Yeah. That would make sense as he was bringing whiskey casks up. But anyway, I think he's a cooper. So yeah. So whenever I read Ronnie Sinclair, I just go, oh, okay, that dude. So Ronnie Sinclair arrives with whiskey casks on his back, complaining about the ridge being on a hill, all this. And so she ignores that. She offers him food. He also has a message from her. And he says the note was from, quote, a tinker on his way to Bellum's Creek. And this note, this is all told orally to him, or to her and to him. It was said, for the healer. So the note was meant for the healer. And my note was, even before we chatted, my note was, poor Ronnie, still single, still a creeper.
Like I said, I mean, it's like it's a cycle. Like, he can't get a woman, so he's cranky, you know, and he can't get a woman because he's cranky. So it's like, it's just a cycle. It's like they excuse his behavior because he can't get a woman, but his behavior is probably why he can't get a woman. So it's like, I don't see him breaking out of that anytime soon, unless there is a widow on the ridge who needs somebody stat.
But whenever even I think of Roger, but even the widow.
Yes.
Whenever I hear widow, I think Widow Douglas.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of Willow.
Oh, what? Wow. Our brains. Didn't you play Widow Douglas?
I did play Widow Douglas.
When you were like 8 or 10?
Yup. Yes, I was. I was the youngest widow I'd ever met.
I think most of us had ever met.
With the worst Southern accent I've ever created. It was bad. But, you know, good times.
Back to blood pudding. Gross. Diana tells us the basics of how it's made over this chapter, the cleaning of the blood, etc.
It feels like she made an entire chapter around a recipe she found online. Or in a book.
Maybe.
She's like, I don't know what to write this chapter, so I'm just going to explain how to make blood pudding. Because you absolutely could make blood pudding based on this recipe. Now, granted, I don't have a freshly butchered pig, but I mean, if I had blood, blah, 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 like I couldn't even say it, blood. If I had blood, and then, you know, it's all like increments, like so much of this, so two, like it's like when you make a drink and you're like one
first
part
you
this,
take
two
your
parts
forearm
that.
And you swish it. You swish it. You grab the fiber and swish
that.
It.
No, not even that. But that was gross too. I'm like, I didn't need to know that. I mean, there's even a recipe in this chapter. Like if you were, I mean, this is by no means a how to be a homesteader book, but if you wanted to make blood pudding and you had a quantity of it, like she was like, well, you put a handful of it's like a drink where you're like one part this, two parts that. So it doesn't matter what the parts are. If you know what it is, you're like, if I have a cup of this, then I know that's one part of this. So if this one cup is two parts blood, then I know that I need half a cup of whatever. So, I mean, you could actually reverse engineer a recipe from this chapter. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. It's funny how as soon as you started talking about chapter recipe thing, I was thinking, you know how annoying it is when we, like you Google, like, okay, I want to make this or this something like a pie or whatever you choose. And you Google it and you're like, oh, you know, you click the top hit or the top second hit, whatever. And you go to a food blog or a recipe blog, whatever. And if it's a recipe blog, usually like what? I can't think of one, like all three recipes or something like that. Usually the recipe blogs are not bad. Like it's a picture, you see the star reviews and it's like, but if you go to a blog, you get, oh, a picture, maybe some reviews, I don't know. But you get, oh, you want to make this? Well, let me tell you about 27 things and 27 paragraphs before I get to that.
I hate it. And here's why I hate it. Because when I'm looking for a recipe online, I usually have eaten it before or have seen it before or have made it before. And I'm looking for specific ingredients. And if I have to scroll through 12 pages just to get to the ingredient list, I mean, I get angry. And plus when I'm doing it on my phone, every ad that has to load makes it slower. And I'm like, no.
Yeah. So I didn't think about that when I was reading, but after you started talking about different things, I was like, you know what? So this thankfully is not that, but imagine a recipe post on a blog. Situated the way, whatever recipe, it could be blood pudding, it doesn't have to be blood pudding, the way this chapter is. So how would this chapter look on a food blog post? It would be black pudding at the top.
That's the title.
Yeah.
But then they're going to go into the backstory of how they slaughtered a pig.
It starts out with her talking about she's elbow or shoulder deep in blood. So what it would be is like step four, it would start step four at the top. Step four, you put your arm down in it and you swish it around to do this and this.
If this chapter were actually formed in the way of a recipe page on a website, my family's been butchering pigs for generations. And once we butcher a pig, there's all of that blood, but we don't let anything go to waste. And my nan always used to say that we should do this. And so when we do this, we do that. But there's still like 30 paragraphs before we're going to get to the actual thing. So they're going to go back into the history of the pig, the person who killed the pig, the history of this particular recipe. Like, it's so much more than you need.
What I'm saying is not that. What I'm saying is if the blog post were formed, sequenced the way the chapter is, it would start out with step four. Your clean, naked arm goes into the barrel to swish around and remove that fibrin. And then it would go into... Exactly.
So gross.
So it would start out with like step four, and maybe it's step 10. I don't know. It would start out with like a step middle of the road, right? And then it would go down and talk about, you know, the last time I did this, I was outside. It was nice. And it was a fresh North Carolina air. And this dude comes up and gives me a message and says it's from a tinker. And he was like, well, he wasn't cursing, but he's kind of a weirdo. He's a little bit sketched, but you know, he does an important job. So we put up with him, and you know, he really needs a wife. So y'all, you know, here's, you know, click here for our email if you want to like go read about this dude. You know, that's how it would be. And then it would be back to it. Mm. Step five, I guess, because she doesn't go out of order when she's outside. But as you said, as we learn about the pig, the prayer, how it took Roger five times to kill it. I don't even know if he killed it. He hit it five times. I don't know if Jamie killed it. I forget that part, but he hit it five times.
He got it eventually.
But I mean, like, the history of how long it took to kill this pig, and then how they put it up in the in the air, in the tree. And I mean, that is like step zero or step negative one, maybe step zero and step one. That's what I'm saying. The chapter starts out at step four, maybe five. I agree with what you're saying. If the chapter were similar to a blog post, it would be like you said. But the chapter is what we have. I'm saying if a blog post, a food blog post, were situated as a chapter, it would actually be worse than the food blog post that you and I hate.
No, that's absolutely true. And then they never give you the actual recipe at the end like you're expecting. So you have to go back through and find it buried in the chapter. You know, I was reading this chapter, and as someone who cooks and has worked with suspect ingredients before, you find a way to disassociate yourself from the animal. Like, you're like, this is no longer that thing. This is meat. This is no longer that thing. This is that. Or these are these bones. Yes, they are in this meat, but this is no longer a chicken animal to me. This is a chicken carcass. So, you know, you find ways to disassociate yourself from the murder of the animal. Correct. Right. However, I would have a really hard time disassociating myself from the fact that this is blood because of the clotting factor, and she's pulling clots out of it. I was like, no, that's too much. Blood sausage is not for me. I could not have made black pudding. I couldn't have. Because there was almost the fact that you're pulling clots out of the thing would have totally been, I would have been unable to disassociate from that at all. I would have been unable.
Yeah, that's kind of disgusting. The coagulation that you got to pull out chunks of.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, and she didn't even have like a sieve or something. Like, she was using her hands. I was like, no.
Well, I think the reason you can use other things, I'm sure. Maybe they didn't make other instruments, but I think the reason she's agitating it is to encourage the clot formation so that she can pull them out. Cause that's
to get them out of
there.
That's
fibrin.
Yeah.
However, and maybe you need to use your hand, at least according to them, not just because you can double job out of it. You can do the movement with your hands, and then while it's there, grab it.
And remove while you do it. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sure there's a really good reason for it. It's just real, real gross. That, and then she was like, but this isn't nearly as bad as when you have to clean out the intestines. And I was like, come on, Diana.
Yeah, I missed that part. So I'm happy I missed it. So back to the black pudding. Diana tells us the basics of how it's made, the cleaning of the blood, etc. And by the way, she just pops in there. Major McDonald is back again. This dude like needs they just need to build him a room, because like this dude is there like every other week or something. And Jamie was with him, helping him do something. So we learned that Roger had tried his hand at killing the pig, and it had not gone very well. Claire tells him that, you know, there's a this is not the wording, this is my wording, but it just popped in my head. Claire says, there's a prayer for that. Like, there's an oil for that.
It's like apple. There's an app for that.
Oh, an app. Yeah. And she says Jamie says a prayer before killing the animal, but she doesn't know if it's the same prayer as the Gralach prayer. probably not, but she doesn't know. So she's like, yeah, so just go talk to, you know, Jamie has that info. So Claire notes that Roger is still, this was very interesting. Again, it makes sense because of, I mean, maybe because she's elbow or shoulder deep in blood. I don't know. She's definitely committed. And Roger is having a hard time or had a hard time, you know, not only because he was inexperienced, that's the most of it, but also he's still very, very reticent in killing.
Yeah, because he was saying that without the prayer, it felt a lot like murder. Like without the thanking of the animal and without the ceremony, it felt like murder. And he was having a hard time disassociating from that. There's a lot of people needing to disassociate in this chapter.
I'm like, this could have technically been in any chapter where Claire shares her observation or Diana shares Claire's observation. But the way she ties it in, the chapter opens with Claire being, as I said, elbow or shoulder deep in literally in blood, right? In one arm. Mm-hmm. And juxtapose that against Roger, who is, yes, inexperienced at killing animals, but also somewhat reticent because he knows it's a need. He knows it's a need, whether he or someone else does it, and he needs to practice. But there's that shift, right, that he hasn't made, not only in his experience of killing things, but in as a time traveler. And so against this backdrop of her having shifted and Roger and the others having not shifted, Claire notes that Roger is still in the phase of TT where after traveling and settling down someplace that it all seems like an elaborate make-believe. The feeling that reality existed in another time, in another place. And she recognizes now that it's only a memory for her and that she believes her illness had pushed her through some final barrier of being in that kind of liminal space where technically I was born in the 20th century. So that was my time, but now I'm in this time, which is also now my time. And so she says that it was her illness that kind of like she pushed through and basically, you know, when she decided not to die and saw Malva and all that crap, right? And she's like, oh no, that will not do. And she came back. She made a decision to come back. So when she decided, like, that was not just for Jamie and for Malva and for everything. That was for her. Like, she believes that that decision, even though Diana did not write it, her decision, her coming through that illness and staying on this earth had pushed her through some final barrier. And that's very interesting because we don't get other than that's more figurative, right? When Claire first falls through the stones in Outlander, the things that she says, and I think we get even a VO of that in season one of the show, when she hears the guns and she sees the red coats and, you know, then eventually or pretty quickly runs into BJR, she is thinking, yeah, she's freaked out at BJR, but at first she's thinking like, is this some kind of costume drama that I've stumbled into? Right. So she understandably, because that's not her time and this is really weird and really odd. This nothing explains it. So if we reach back a little bit or a lot of bit, we see Claire having as a time traveler, as an outlander, as a traveler in general, she's gone through such a journey of obviously falling through accidentally and being literally faced with something like her literally having the thought, this is make believe. I've stumbled into a costume drama. And then, of course, she's proven wrong. And over a few weeks, she gets to Liach and Lisa. She starts to realize like, oh my gosh, the only answer can actually be this one. And it makes no sense. I don't know how it happened, but it has to be the truth. So she fights that in the beginning. And her journey is completely different from Brianna and Roger's. But it's so interesting to see that we have, even only in less than a paragraph, a little discussion of this by Diana of Claire and that shift, because we don't get that a lot. We really don't get, we get her thinking about the past or thinking about, you know, Brianna, thinking about telephones and, you know, and World War II. We get her thinking about her time of origin, but we don't get language like this about what would be our past, her past, as far as, you know, her being a 20th century woman. So the 18th century being this other time, you know, this almost make-believe time. We don't get that. I don't think we've gotten that since book one. And so it's very interesting to see that and see how she juxtaposes not just Claire's like major shift, but also against Roger and Brianna, whom she basically says are like, they're still, and she's not, it does not come across as rude or mean at all, but she's just making an observation. Like, they're still playing make-believe. They're still playing mentally. They're in a different place. Like, they're going through the motions. They are doing what needs to be done to survive in this time, but they're not, it's like, they're not committed. They're not committed. And that's the difference she sees, which is really interesting. And then Jamie joins Claire and Roger as they're chatting, and he reports that McDonald is still there, going on and on about the Committee of Safety, and Jamie had to get away. Then Jamie answers that question about the prayer that Claire had mentioned to Roger. She says, tell it to us in English. So he does. He recites it in English. And after cleaning up all the blood pudding efforts, Claire finally gets a chance to read the note that Sinclair had brought for the healer. When you listen to this, when you listen to the audiobook, right, you get the message. But unless you're reading it in the print, it's not as funny. Audibly, you hear what the letter said. But when you read it, you're like, well, okay. So it said, you come, and then it said Phaedry. So who it was from, Phaedry. But the way that is spelled in the book is Y-U space C-U-M. So you don't get that little bit of, you know, ha-ha just from listening. So we are to believe that it's from Phaedra, the Phaedra we know, because people do call her Phaedry. And she wants Claire, or maybe it could be Jamie, to come somewhere. We don't know. So we learned that Brianna had learned... That's not right. We learned that Phaedra had learned to read and write from Brianna when she'd stayed there during her pregnancy. So when they first saw it, like, this can't be from Phaedra, because does she know how to write? And Bri's like, oh yeah, I taught her. I taught her. She's good. She knows the basics. But then she had to stop. She was stopped by, we don't know exactly who, but we know she had to stop. Or Phaedra said she had to stop, I should say. They do believe the note is from Phaedra, but they don't know if she wanted Claire or if she wanted Jamie. Because there was no names in there. So the two of them decide, Jamie and Claire, they will go down, it will go down the mountain when she comes. They will go to River Run to see what's going on. So this little break that will have since been edited by the time you hear this, if you notice that there was not a lot of summer going on at the end of our chat about chapter 71, that's because Summer's wife, something happened on her side, and I didn't know she had, because she stayed in the room in our quote unquote little recording room. I could see her line of her audio. Well, excuse me, that's not true. I couldn't see her line of audio, even though she was, if I had looked, it would have said she's offline. However, I get no audible notification when something happens because I'm in my email reading my notes, so, or going through the script, right? And so, and she had, I think she had texted me, but I keep, so it doesn't join the recording, I keep my phone on silent. So after I finish, I'm like, oh, she just doesn't want to, she has nothing to say. Okay, fine. So I get to the end of the chapter and I'm like, did you have anything else to say? And I go over to our recording window and she's offline. So I looked at it and we looked at the files. There was an issue, but so we lost the last few minutes of her. Not, we didn't lose anything she actually recorded, but her internet or something.
No, because my computer was dead.
Took a nosedive. But since my computer was still going, I still chatted on like I usually do. Unbeknownst to me, she was just gone.
She was like, this is so nice. She's like listening to everything I say. I must be so interesting.
Right, I knew now. I was not. You know, stop it.
You know, you were like, this is like, must be the best like episode breakdown I've ever had.
Of course
Summer
not.
Summer is just speechless with how amazing my deduction is.
Don't be stupid. Come on. So that's why normally in between chapters, there is no in between chapters. We finished a discussion and Summer goes, okay, and now blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, we wanted to jump in and say what happened, why it was so quiet in case you wondered. That's what.
Yeah. I'm honestly just glad we were able to keep what we already had, because the idea of having to re-record an entire chapter was making me nauseous. That was chapter 71. Moving right along to chapter 72, entitled Betrayals.
So in this chapter, Jamie and Claire arrive at River Run. An enslaved woman, whom they did not recognize, answer the door. So that's obviously not Phaedra. They go in to see Jocasta. And it turns out Duncan and Ulysses are gone, too. They're looking for Phaedra. She says that she's run away. Jocasta says that Phaedra's run away. That's what she first says. And then she goes, or she's been stolen. And they find out she'd been gone for 4 weeks. And Duncan and Ulysses had gone after about 2 weeks. So that's the timeline we have. Mia N. writes, our favorite couple next meets a, quote, brown bundle of fur. What is that? Asks Jamie. It's a wee dog. What do you think? Jocasta says,
I've seen dogs where I've had that thought too.
What is that?
Like any kind of a mixed.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, there are breeds I've never seen before where I'd be like, what is that? But like you've seen like definitely mixed animals because I know that people have been breeding animals forever, but I have a hard time believing that there is pure breeders in the mountains of North Carolina at this time. So it would be like,
I don't think Jocasta's in the mountains.
My dog had puppies. I know, well, wherever, but I'm just like, my dog had puppies. Do you want a puppy? Oh, look, I found a guy who was selling puppies. Like, it would seem more realistic to me that they found somebody selling puppies and went, I'm just going to get a puppy, as opposed to, I'm going to order this very specific breed of dog and I'm going to wait for it to be born and then it's going to arrive and then now you have a puppy. It could have happened that way, but in my brain, I don't see that being the way it happened.
So Mia N continues. So Jocasta says acerbically, the sarcasm here has me laughing out loud. Even better, their names are Samson and Delilah, the dogs. Hmm. We next learn that Phaedra has, quote, run away. As I said, Duncan and Ulysses have gone to find her. So Jamie asks Jocasta why Phaedra would run. And she says, I don't know. And then they tell her about the note. And Jamie says, maybe Phaedra thought that Jocasta would sell her. At which Jocasta laughed and laughed, like hooted. And hollered.
I had a lot of feelings about, I mean, she, obviously you're going to go into how she walks them very knowingly into the supply room where she has boxes of old paintings. Obviously you're going to talk about that. But I'm more interested in talking about the potential reasons why. Because even Jamie and Claire don't 100% know why. Why just having those, just knowing, because knowing the parentage of Phaedra, I'm like, I personally was trying to figure out her actual, like, why. Like, is she saying she would never sell her because she still wants to punish Hector, even though he's dead? Like, punish him forever after and all of his ill-begotten offspring? Or does she feel, like, a kinship towards her? Like, does she care for her? Or is it a deep-seated need to punish Hector after death? Like, I even still don't know after reading this whole chapter.
As far as her motivations, yeah, we don't get a lot of that. So after she laughs and laughs and laughs, she takes them out to the stables and the carriage barn. She tells Jamie exactly where to find a specific box and where it's located, and she wants him to get it down. They got it. They got it open, and it is filled with, and this is not my language, this is Diana's language, pictures. Remember, pictures not doesn't mean necessarily a photo, right? It can be any, a photo is a type of picture, right? A picture can just be an image of something, whether it's painted, drawn, or a photograph. So we find out really quickly that it's like a box of Jocasta's old drawings and paintings. And she tells him to go find one of an old man. They see one of Hector Cameron. And then she has him bring out one of Phaedra as a teenager. And in Diana's language and Diana's writing, she goes, Phaedra, it was her pretty face over Hector Cameron's bones. And this is what Summer meant. Once the reader learns that Phaedra is Hector Cameron's daughter, right? Once we find this out, we then have to imagine what might have made Jocasta hoot and holler.
Like, she's either grown to care for her or she's still punishing Hector. Like, it has to be.
I think she's grown to care for her, or at the very least, because she's blind, she has grown to depend on her. And I know that Ulysses is her right-hand man, but Ulysses isn't, like, you know, doesn't bathe her, doesn't clean her, doesn't do, you know. I mean, maybe Jocasta can bathe herself. That's not what I'm saying. My point is, there are certain things that Ulysses is not going to do.
Right. But couldn't you also see the backhandedness of forcing your husband's illegitimate daughter to care for you and your body for the rest of your life?
Potentially, yeah.
Like, I could see that being a punishment to Hector ad nauseum, you know, forever. Whereas she, it could be opposite. Like, I've given you this great place in the house so you don't have to toil. You know, you're a house servant as opposed to a field servant. So you're not treated as, I mean, you're still treated poorly. I'm not trying to say that there's ever a level of slavery that's better than another. It's all slavery. But I mean, it's not the same labor as a field slave would have. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like an elevated position, but at the same time being forced to bodily care for a woman who may or may not be punishing you for it. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's thoughts.
Is there a chance that you might have intended to sell her, to sell Fedra, and then the instantaneous reaction is this hooting laughter?
Yeah.
It's there's no time to think about it. It's like that was her gut reaction. So the first thing that I think of as to why someone would laugh is that it's so incongruent.
Yeah.
It is so incongruent with the actual truth that is ludicrous to her. Like that is not, to me, that right there, that laugh, that instantaneous laughter is like, there's no way she would ever have sold her. So it's a no. Now the reason is what we're having to guess at, right? So the answer is no, she would never have sold her because that's what Dorcas's laugh tells us.
But it still doesn't tell us why. Like we know that. Yeah.
And you're right. It could be because she was Hector's or is still Hector's, but Hector's gone. Whether it's, she has no, I don't believe any, like she doesn't miss Hector. So it's not about nostalgia, but it still could be that that's, you know, it's part of him. Not that she misses him, but it's, who knows? Maybe when he was still alive, maybe he said, this is, I'm sure, and she knew, probably didn't, she didn't have to be told, especially once as Fedra grew up. But if Hector knew, which he must have known, right? Because he's only been gone 5 or 6 or 7 years or so. If Hector knew, then he could have laid down the law and said, she's, you know, yeah, she's mine. I'm not really going to, you know, acknowledge her. Like there is no like legal acknowledgement, but I'm not going to. Yeah. Anyway, so remember her mother, Betty, the one who that the show didn't have with the whole slave that died, the enslaved woman that died in book 5. So her mother, which means Hector Cameron was getting it on with Betty. Betty was already a house servant. In some capacity, maybe not the same capacity as Fedra, but she was already working in the house or at least cooking maybe outside in the outside kitchen. But she was already involved in house labor, house related labor. So that makes sense. Although Hector could have gone anywhere. I'm not putting that past him. But it makes sense that if someone was already a little bit easier when you don't have to go looking for it. Anyway, so we don't know. We have no idea if he had any feelings for Betty. Again, not that it makes it right, but we don't know what his mindset was.
Well, we don't know the nature of their relationship. We do know that there was a power imbalance, so there is no way that it was 100% consensual. But, you know, we don't know what we don't know.
So, well, we don't know the nature of their relationship.
What Diana doesn't tell
us. We don't know if, because he knew that Betty got pregnant and knew there was a daughter and he knew it was his, it's possible he could have been the one to place Fedra in the house to serve Jocasta.
But I honestly, and maybe this is just me answering my own questions, but I feel like if it was Hector's decree that she stay in the house, if she was completely against it, she would have 100%. That would have been the first thing she would have gotten rid of when Hector died. If she had contempt for her.
I don't know that she had contempt for her, and I don't know that she would have been against it. She would have not loved the fact, obviously, that her husband, not just that her husband was getting around, but that everybody knew, at least all the enslaved people knew what was going on. And here was his daughter, you know, serving her, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we don't know. We may never know the exact reason why she never intends to sell Fedra. And we could do, you know, hours, you know, speculating on that. They find it. They see that Fedra is like, she has Hector's bones, facial bones, his everything. So that kind of answers a question, not the question, but a question. Mia N. writes, Jocasta takes him to the carriage barn where she has stored a number of her old paintings, etc. And this section breaks my heart as an artist. How terribly sad that Jocasta has lost the ability to create art. Quote, she stood still, eyes closed, and I could tell that she was inhaling deeply, breathing in the smell of the pictures. Unquote.
Yeah, and she could still feel them. Like she knew it was the right one by touching it. Like just the texture of the paint on canvas. Now, I I don't paint a lot, but when I do paint, I still don't think I would be able to tell it was my painting by the texture of the paint on the canvas. Yeah. But I mean, I've not lost my sight. So I have not ever honed my ability to see with my hands like that.
Mia N. continues, through portraiture, we learned that Hector Cameron fathered Phaedra. Quote, she wore a simple kerchief bound over her hair that threw the bones of her face into bold relief. Hector Cameron's bones. Unquote. We are later reminded that Jocasta also already blamed Hector for the death of her girls.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could see her being, keeping her around and feeling even more upset about one of his children surviving when none of hers did. I don't know. She's so complicated. Dang it, Diana.
Dang it, Diana. Just then, they note that Duncan and Ulysses have come back. But we find out they had not found her. Jamie wonders if indeed Phaedra had diddled with Duncan. And when they get Duncan alone, he spills the beans.
You know what? I have a thought here. As a reader, I'm super glad that Claire was present for this conversation with Duncan. But thinking about the realistic nature of it, I don't think he would have taken Claire to have this conversation with Duncan. I do not believe that Duncan would have been this forthcoming in the presence of all the people. Like, this would have been a conversation, especially knowing what he was going to ask mm-hmm. him. I think that Duncan would not have been, I think that it would have been more delicate to the nature of the type of conversation for him to have had it privately with Duncan by himself. As a reader, I feel like it's easier for us to read it from Claire's point of view because she is our narrator. But I think it would have been more realistic for Jamie to have come back after the fact and said, well, I talked to him and here's what he said. I have a hard time thinking that Jamie would have taken her to have this conversation with Duncan.
I don't have a hard time thinking Jamie would have. I mean, I can see it both ways. I do have a hard time believing that Duncan would spill the beans in front of her. Because if you remember before their marriage, before their wedding,
he didn't want to talk about the other.
I mean, he was so nervous and nauseous that his bowels were gone. Like he was so mm-hmm. so nervous and everything. And we learn that Phaedra hadn't taken any money with her when she left. But now they think she was taken and hadn't run. So she was not prepared. She did not have any money with her. It wasn't planned, right? It doesn't look like or appear like or seem like she made any preparations before she would have run.
Like she just went.
Yes.
Which means, and I don't think she would have just went.
How would an enslaved person survive outside?
Yeah.
Because at the very worst, you're considered a runaway in which you can be killed and taken, mm-hmm. if not taken back to your person.
Yeah.
So if for no other reason than not being shot on the road by a slave catcher, or even if, because Jocasta didn't know where she had gone, right? So she didn't know who'd, plus she wouldn't want her hurt in a capture. They now believe she was taken. And then they realize that Ulysses might be involved because he was Jocasta's right-hand man, her eyes, etc. So if Duncan spills the beans, we find out that Duncan and Phaedra, we don't know what the nature of their relationship was like other than sexual. We don't know if there was feelings in there or not, if there were feelings or not. But it was definitely of a sexual nature. And that was the first, that is the first thing. And they believe she was taken. So if you put those things together, regardless of who did the taking, and if Jocasta knows nothing and Duncan knows nothing, what might make the most sense? Ulysses doing something, right? Because he finds out, mm-hmm. he obviously would have been against it because he's standing up for because Ulysses knows, like he knows what's going on in the house. So he knows he's the dude. He knows pretty much everything. But he's not.
He's the dude.
The man. He's not going to know. Obviously, he becomes aware. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler. He obviously at some point somehow becomes aware of Duncan and Phaedra. Their guess is that if Ulysses is involved in some way, then he had to have most likely known about or found out about Duncan and Phaedra. So if that is the case, and he did something to remove Phaedra or have her removed from the house because either it didn't stop or they kept going or maybe just because it happened at all.
You also have to remember that he was around when Betty had the Phaedra thing go down, when Betty and Hector. So he has a very vivid remembrance of what went down when her last husband diddled the house lady.
Yes. So, yeah. And that brings in another layer, which was he trying to protect having another Fedra being born, this time of Fedra? That's weird.
Or is he trying to protect Jocasta from the truth of it?
Probably, yes. But think about this. If Fedra had gotten pregnant by Duncan, that mm-hmm. offspring would have been offspring of both husbands. That's wackadoodle.
It's true. But I think if you look at all of Ulysses' machinations over the course of the books, almost everything he does is for Jocasta, because they always play up that thing that they think that he loves her. You know what I mean? That he has feelings for her that are deeper than just that are protective in nature and such. And knowing that how whatever went down with Phaedra's mom and Hector Cameron, how much that hurt her. I think that honestly, he doesn't want her to have to see the same thing happen with her next husband that happened with the last. So I think that everything Ulysses does, while I think he cares for Fedra, I think he cares more for Jocasta. And I think he's more protective of her than he is of Fedra.
Jocasta is his number one. That's not a question. What I don't know, and I'm not saying you're wrong about what could have happened, because regardless of what the truth was, he very likely was trying to protect her in some way. We never find out if Jocasta was upset. Now, okay, I don't get the feeling that she was ever in love with Hector. Like, that's not even a thing. Whatever. But yeah, after she lost her daughter, her last daughter, and before they came to North Carolina, I think like whatever they had together, whatever it was dead.
Yeah.
And so I don't think she cared if he slept with half the town. Honestly, I don't. The problem was potentially that, not that she cared if he was with someone else, but because he was with an enslaved person in their, not only on their land, in their house, and then begot a child, like that's not just you doing it. That's there being quote unquote photographic human evidence that looks just like him walking around. And so it's everyone knowing. Now, as I understand, it was not uncommon for masters to obviously take what they wanted, right? Physically of enslaved people. So I'm not saying he was unusual, but I don't really think Jocasta cared the fact that he was unfaithful. If she had any strong feelings, it was potentially the fact that the result or the evidence of his unfaithfulness was there for everyone to see every day.
But then you think about it. Yes, everyone can see it every day. Absolutely. And Duncan's main concern was that he didn't want what he did to reflect badly on her, right? But then on top of that, you know, they took down every portrait of Hector in the house. So no, there are no portraits of Hector. So no one notices that Fedra looked like him. So that's not something new. But also knowing the people who knowing what she's already had to endure because of Hector's infidelity, to think of her having to endure further ridicule because of her new husband's infidelity, basically, even with the child produced of the last infidelity. I mean, that's just
insult upon injury.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. That's, it's a lot. Yeah. So we may never know the exact like motivation for her not getting rid of Fedra or her whatever, or never getting rid of Fedra. But we do know that gut reaction, that like hysterical laugh, like, yeah, right. I would never, like, that's her answer. That's her no. She would never get rid of her. We have that answer. After that, she shows them a picture of Hector and of hers. Like, are we supposed to think then that my laughter says, no, I wouldn't. Or how could you think that? Look at this. It's still not honest. All it does is show us that they're related. It doesn't show us, does not tell us, as you said, it does not tell us the actual answer. Are we to assume that just because it's his child, that's reason enough for you not to get rid of him? Her? I don't know.
It's an answer that begets more questions. I mean, it's a non-answer. It's an answer that's a non-answer. So, I mean,
it's Diana's fault.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. And then, of course, as they're leaving, Jamie says to Jocasta, nothing bad will come to Duncan. Like, he's afraid she's going to
go after him.
Yeah. So if she didn't know, she knows now, honestly.
Yeah. So they don't stay long at River Run. They leave the next morning. And as they leave, Jamie tells Jocasta, quote, I should take it very much amiss if were any harm to come to Duncan, unquote. And he tells her that he knows. meaning now Jocasta knows that they know that Duncan and Fedra were knocking boots.
Mm-hmm.
And he expects to find Duncan in good health when he returns.
Yep.
Mia N closes us out with, who exactly is betrayed in this chapter? The answer? Jocasta, again and again. She's betrayed by Fedra, Duncan, and the deceased Hector. She is even betrayed by Jamie, in a sense. She's also betrayed by her own body in the loss of her eyesight and the practice of her art. We even have the symbolism of the dog's names. Delilah biblically betrayed Samson, after all. I also want to point out a lovely, intimate Claire mannerism as described by Diana that we have seen Katrina do several times through her years of interpreting this role. Quote, I touched his lips, ran my thumb lightly along it, unquote.
And that is chapter 72. Join us next time when we will be rounding up part 9, because there's no point in straddling a part. So we're going to do 73.
We try not to.
I know. 73, double dealing. 74, so romantic. And 75, lice. How many chapters? We've had multiple chapters with lice in it. Have we not?
Diana
in other books?
Doesn't. Yeah, it started with when they were mentioned. Well, maybe not lice. Yeah, lice, like pubic lice or lice that goes in your pubes. I don't know. When just before Culloden, when they're camping out, or not, and it could have been in Outlander. I think it was in Outlander or in Dragonfly and Amber. Just before as they're going to war between the different battles or whatever, when they're around a campfire and they talk about lice in your pubes or something like that. So
yeah, just lice in general. Like, I can't even read or hear the word lice without scratching my head. And I hate that. And I have not personally had to experience lice in years, but lice is like world ending until they're gone. Like, that is your world until they're gone. So I am not looking forward to chapter 75, but it is blessedly only 9 pages long. So hopefully we won't have to dwell on it for too long. But join us for that. And if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can always go to our Facebook page at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Alistair H. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in having any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can visit our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
And if you haven't joined our text community, why not? It's free. Text hello to 916-659-5112. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.